"I've no wish to see the inside of your 5 favourite taverns," I said, biting back disappointment at missing a lesson. "Don't be absurd. I've 8 favourite taverns, thank you very much. Besides, Blackwood's coming along." He laughed at my pained expression. "My thoughts exactly. You should have heard him grumble. I actually found him in the training room after breakfast, running through his manoeuvres. Just for extra practice," he said. "I suppose you have plans that Lord Blackwood won't like at all?"
"On the contrary. I've designed an educational outing."
He grinned with excitement, but said no more. We rumbled along in a gripper's carriage, Blackwood and Magnus seated opposite me. As we drove, people on the street smiled and bowed to us.
"The carriage has a gripper's seal on the door," Magnus said. He waved through the window. "They love Master Agrippa. They'll love you as well."
"Unless I fail." I was still focused on yesterday's lesson. "What happens if I don't receive the Queen's commendation in June?" I asked Blackwood, certain he, of all people, would answer with honesty.
"You won't be a sorcerer, Miss Howe."
He stated it matter-of-factly, as if I'd inquired about the weather.
"On the rare occasion that an incumbent cannot complete the assigned manoeuvres, his stave is taken from him, and he's removed from the family record in disgrace."
"So I'd receive the same punishment as someone who's trained these past 2 years?" The panic of my botched lesson came thundering back, but I held it inside.
"They need to know you're the one named in the prophecy. If you're not what Her Majesty seeks, you won't be encouraged to develop those abilities," Blackwood said, his tone effortlessly cool.
"I doubt she'll be capable," he'd said to Agrippa.
"Most feel that women should not learn magic."
"Do you?" I raised my eyebrows.
"I support whatever the Order thinks is right," he said after a moment of careful consideration.
"How very generous."
"Blackie, much as I adore your conversational contributions, I really think we should focus on enjoying the day," Magnus said.
He knocked Blackwood's hat off his head for emphasis. They took me to St. Paul's Cathedral, at Blackwood's suggestion. Magnus stifled a groan as we walked up the church steps. We passed along the nave, and I marveled at the marble floors and golden ceilings decorated with angels. Down in the crypt, we visited Christopher Wren's tomb, surrounded by an iron gate. The grave was topped with a slab of obsidian.
"Wren came from a fine sorcerer family," Magnus said. "That's why the obsidian. All sorcerers try to be buried with some piece of it on them."
He whistled, listening to the echo play off the walls.
"Nice place for eternal rest, but I prefer Poet's Corner in Westminster Abbey." "You wouldn't like it, probably. You're not one for poets or playwrights, are you, Miss Howell?"
Magnus paused before a collection of prayer candles. With a sweep of his stave, he lit them. Their glow highlighted his hair and played on his cheekbones. If he wanted me to notice how handsome he was, perhaps he was succeeding. I didn't say I hated them, only that I had no time for them. He responded in a low, powerful tone, speaking the words.
"What a piece of work is man! How noble in reason, how infinite in faculty! In form and moving, how express and admirable! In action, how like an angel!"
His voice reverberated in the great space, soft, yet clear.
"That's Hamlet."
"You should have been an actor." I was impressed.
"Do you think?"
He seemed pleased.
"Sometimes I imagine I'd give up sorcery and duty just for the opportunity to tour the countryside with a small troupe. Mother always said I had a knack for voices."
Blackwood came by and hushed us. After my tour, we stopped at an inn for lunch, complete with chops and potatoes and ale. A few more months eating this way, and I might attain some feminine curves. Magnus entertained us with stories and jokes, but I tried bringing Blackwood into the conversation. Despite how badly our relationship had begun, I wanted us to be civil. It would make training easier. "How old were you when you became the Earl of Sorrowfell, my lord?" I asked.
"I was 8 when my father died," Blackwood replied, studying his half-drunk ale. "The youngest seal-bearer in the history of my family." They thought that was terribly exciting.
"I'm so sorry," I said. I meant it. To be that young and head of a family was one thing, but seal-bearers were responsible for their entire magical line. The pressure would have been tremendous.
"Father died battling Hvelum in his country's service. It was a noble end," Blackwood said, as emotionless as if he were reading the words out of a book. "What of your family?"
"Father died before I was born. Mother soon after." I felt uncomfortable, as I always did when talking about my parents. I had no memories, no connections. I wished I could feel something more than curiosity and longing when I thought about them. He nodded.
"So, you truly grew up at Brimthorn?"
"Well, I lived in Devon until I was 5.
There. There was a real memory. A real flash of pain.
Blackwood noticed.
"Why did you leave?"
I thought of my aunt walking away from me, back to her carriage, and me, hanging onto her skirt, begging her to take me home. She hadn't listened. She hadn't cared. "Several reasons," I said quickly. "The war, for one. I'm sorry that training in London left you so little time on your estate. As I've said, the girls at Brimthorn would have loved to meet their great benefactor."
"I visited Brimthorn before. I might have seen you. We just would not have been formally introduced."
"Of course not. He was an earl's son, and I, a charity girl. Very little chance of meeting."
"Before the war, Sorrowfell used to host events for the Brimthorn children. I'd have continued the tradition, but I couldn't arrange it from London. It's better to be present for those sorts of things."
"Yes. One of the wretched girls might make off with the silver tucked under her bonnet," I said.
Magnus snickered. "I don't like strangers on the estate when I'm not there," he said defensively, as if this were an old argument.
"Perhaps it's for the best. Sorrowfell sounds like a gloomy place for a picnic."
"No. It's beautiful." Blackwood's expression cleared. "The founding earl received it as a gift from a fairy lord. The land is steeped in magic. Some find it rather melancholy."
No wonder he loved it.
"But the forests and grounds are deep and lush. White stags live on the property. My father always forbade a stag hunt, as he said it would be wrong to kill any magical creature. My father..."
The light vanished from his face in an instant, and he said no more. "Do you see Sorrowfell often?" I asked, feeling a small flash of sympathy.
"No. My studies keep me in London."
He withdrew into himself. I couldn't get another word. A pretty serving girl arrived with more ale. Magnus winked at her, sending her into a giggling frenzy. After lunch, Magnus hustled me toward the carriage.
"We have to move fast, or all the best spots will be taken," he said.
"For what?" I asked, as we drove down the street.
"Have you ever seen a ship launch before?"
The docks were outside the protected area. Living in Agrippa's fine house only made the devastation I witnessed beyond the ward more terrible. Magnus talked, but I didn't pay much attention.
I watched the burned houses and debris-strewn streets roll past the window. Just sitting in a fine carriage made me feel guilty. We got out at the docks, elbowing our way through crowds as they waved handkerchiefs and flags. Squeezing between them, we strained to catch a glimpse above the throng of cheering humanity. A massive sailing ship moved down the river, toward the sea. It was a great square man of war, with billowing white sails and an unfurled blue flag. The launch had the air of a national celebration.
A small brass band played as men selling apples and meat pies moved through the crowd.
"Isn't it wonderful?" Magnus cried. He seemed to glow with excitement. "You want to go with them when you're commended?" I was impressed, despite myself. With Nemneris, the water spider attacking the coast, the navy was about the most dangerous place for a sorcerer. "Yes, I don't want to stay here and uphold the ward. Put me in the midst of the battle. I'm ready." He whooped and threw his hat into the air. The people around us applauded his enthusiasm. "I never thought so many would turn up for a ship launch," I said. Some poor woman sobbed beside me as she waved her handkerchief toward the departing vessel. Then again, perhaps seeing any boat leave the harbor was cause for celebration. Even if a ship got past the water spider, the English were persona non grata on the continent. Europe did not want to invoke Relham's wrath by aiding refugees. "Do ships never come in?" I asked. Magnus easily followed my train of thought. "Well, naturally, there's been some contact. How else would Cellini have arrived? Italy's the only nation that will offer assistance. Other than that, dear Miss Howell, we are on our own. Here, cling to me for comfort." When I didn't fall into his arms, he continued. "You hear of smugglers taking men and women out of England, heading for America. They'll charge a fellow a king's ransom for the chance to escape to a new life. Just between us, if I'm to choose between Korozov and a Yankee tavern brawl, I'll take my chances with old Shadow and Fog any day." Blackwood came over to us, jostled by a drunkard and his chums. "We should escort Miss Howell home. The people are getting rowdy." As we walked through the crowd, I studied the faces about me. Many looked pinched and worn with hunger, with tiredness. I knew these people, how they felt. I certainly understood them better than I did the sorcerers. Rushing back behind the safety of the ward didn't appeal to me. "Wait," I said as we walked toward the carriage. "We're here anyway. What's to stop us from looking about?" "You want to see the slums?" Magnus sounded puzzled. "I don't think it's the safest idea," Blackwood said. "If I'm going to fight for London, I should see how all of its people live." "Perhaps one day, but not now," Blackwood said, taking my arm. He spoke with beleaguered patience, as if I were an errant child. I shook myself firmly out of his grasp. "Don't you ever make charity calls?" "Look." I held up my reticule. Inside, I had the 3 shillings I'd saved from my time at Brimthorn. A poor savings after 11 years, but it would do. I'd rather give this to someone who needs it than spend it on myself, especially now that I have so much. "Come on, just through Halfpenny Row. It's not too dangerous there." Blackwood set his jaw. "I said no." "Let's put it to a vote," I said, ignoring his order. I raised my hand into the air. "I vote yes." "No," he said again. "I say yes as well." Magnus winked at me. "I want to stretch my legs." He extended his arm, and I took it, like a proper lady. "Thank you, sir. That suits me perfectly." Together, We strolled past a scowling Blackwood. "A short visit," he muttered, stalking after us. "Here's an idea," Magnus said as we followed the surging crowds away from the docks. "Since you're to be a sorcerer, Miss Howell, perhaps we should address you as one. We all use our plain surnames with one another, so may I call you Howell?" I wanted to be one of them, didn't I? "All right. Shall I call you Magnus?"
"Perfection. What do you say, Blackwood? Is she Howell the sorcerer?"
"Miss Howell is a lady. One must always address ladies with proper respect." Blackwood nodded to me, the image of politeness. But I understood. He would not acknowledge me as his equal. He did not consider me a sorcerer. In the row, the people pressed so close, I wondered if we mightn't all congeal together into a quivering slab. We passed the little girls in black dresses holding trays of totems, each trying to outshout the others. I stopped before one of them, a tiny blonde creature with a clean face, but the dirtiest hands I'd ever seen. She offered a figure with tentacles erupting from its center.
"Please you, miss, here's Korizoff, great shadow and fog, for protecting. Save yourself and your family. Tuppence only, miss."
With a start, I recognized her from the street the day before, when she had been crushed by our carriage. She gasped, remembering me as well.
"There you are, miss. He told me you'd be by."
"What? Who?" The hair along my neck prickled.
"The magician, Jenkins Hargrove. Says you have to come with me to meet him, miss. He'd love to talk to you with Mr. Hargrove."
"How do you know where I'd be?"
"He told you to come."
She said it as though I were very silly for not understanding.
"While you were sleeping?"
Yesterday, Jenkins Hargrove had spoken to me in a dream. I shook my head slowly. "That's impossible."
"Nothing's impossible with Mr. Hargrove. Come on, then," she said, grabbing my hand. "We'll go together."
"I can't," I whispered, looking over my shoulder. "There are two others with me." Magnus caught up with us. The girl pretended we hadn't been having a serious conversation.
"Buy a totem for tuppence, sir," she said to Magnus. "Ward your home and family."
Magnus handed the child two shiny pennies, which she snatched away and hid within her clothes.
"What's your name?" he asked.
"Charlie,"
the girl said, a bit wary.
"Don't be afraid, Charlie," Magnus crouched to see eye to eye with her. "We're sorcerers."
He made the totem in his palm rise and wobble on a current of air. Charlie clapped with delight. Magnus's ease with her was rather sweet. I knelt beside them.
"I was just telling Charlie that we came to see what life is like for her."
"Life is very good, sir," the child said.
"Where do you live?" Magnus asked.
"With the magician, Mr. Jenkins Hargrove. We sell totems for him, and he gives us a place to sleep at night,"
Charlie said. Blackwood pushed through the crowd and came up to us. When Charlie saw him, she jumped.
"Oh, my lord, didn't think to see you again till next week,"
she curtsied to him. I looked up in surprise. Blackwood stayed perfectly still, as if a sudden movement would set off a trap. What was all this?
"How do you know little Charlie?"
I asked, standing.
"My family performs charity work."
He took care not to look at me. "I thought you weren't so keen on charity." I raised my eyebrow.
"I never said that," he muttered.
"He comes to see us every Friday,"
Charlie beamed.
"Pretty regular charity to hand over to some old conjurer,"
Magnus said, studying Blackwood as if memorizing his uncomfortable expression.
"Jenkins Hargrove is the greatest magician of the age."
Charlie held tight to her little wooden tray.
"What say we pay a visit to the greatest magician of the age right now?"
Magnus said. I flinched. I didn't want to meet this man with Magnus and Blackwood in tow. Take us home to meet your master, Charlie, and you'll have a bright new guinea. Blackwood looked up and down the avenue for some method of escape. My stomach cramped.
Perhaps another day, I said to Magnus.
Maybe not today, sir, Charlie muttered, though she looked tempted. What if I make it 2 guineas?
He took the gleaming coins from his pocket and showed them to the girl. That did the trick.
Follow me,
Charlie spun about and ran.
I think it's getting late, I said to Magnus, trying to hide my desperation.
You want to rob a poor little girl?
He asked with mock innocence, and walked after her, wearing a mischievous grin. Blackwood appeared to have frozen in place.
Do you want to leave? I said. No, let's get this over with.
He led us after the others. Charlie guided us onto quieter, more cramped avenues. On the way, we passed wreckage of burned houses and hovels, scorched buildings with broken windows and smoke-blackened walls. The smell of damp and rot permeated the air.
Korozov mostly attacks at night, Charlie said, happily playing tour guide. Lot of people lost their homes.
On the corner opposite us, a bare-knuckle boxing match was in full swing. 2 shirtless fellows circled each other, punching and jabbing as a smell of sweat and blood and ale filled the air. Drunken men jeered and shouted as they watched.
They're animals, Blackwood said, shielding me from view.
They're desperate, I said sadly.
They feel cheap, so that's how they behave. To our left, women in pancake makeup and rouge slid shawls from their shoulders to reveal pushed-up breasts and bare arms. They smiled at Magnus and Blackwood, who looked away. Charlie took us down an alleyway, past 2 dirty and ragged men begging with tin cups. I gave them each a coin. As we rounded the corner, I gasped. An unclean man huddled against the brick wall, gazing blankly at the world ahead. There was no question that he'd been touched. His right arm had ballooned to a grotesque degree, the flesh white and pale green and patched with rot. The entire right side of the man's head had swollen to 3 times its normal size, so that he had to lean it against the wall in an effort not to tip over. A few wisps of hair dotted his scalp. Shiny, clear fluid dribbled out of his eyes, so foul-smelling as to make one sick. It was clear which ancient was responsible. Molochoron, a great festering ball of mould and filth, had touched this man. Touched, but not killed him. I knelt before him, a handkerchief to my nose.
Is there anything I can do? I asked.
The man didn't respond. His breathing sounded raspy and soft.
He can't hear you, Charlie said. He's dead to the world.
I took the last coin I had and pressed it into his hand. Magnus gently urged me to follow the group. We moved along a flight of rickety wooden stairs that led up the side of a brick building. There was a door at the top, which bore the painted words, Jenkins Hargrove, magician and conjurer, tarot and charms, no love potions. Charlie knocked. A little boy with a dirty face opened the door, and inside we found 5 other children working in a corner. A stove kept the room quite warm. The children were carving pieces of dark wood to make more totems.
This is my home, Charlie said.
Besides the mattress and the stove, the only other furnishings were a wooden table and 4 chairs. The table was covered with glass bottles and tin cups. Though outside it was a bright afternoon, grime caked the windows so completely that we remained shuttered in twilight. The walls were exposed brick and chunks of broken plaster. Walking around the bare space, I noticed a patchwork curtain separating a corner of the hovel into its own private area. Charlie hugged two of the children and introduced them to Magnus as her sister and brother. They pecked her with questions. Had she brought them anything to eat? Did she sell any totems? "Where are your parents?" I said.
"Dead and gone, miss,"
Charlie replied. Magnus gave her 2 guineas. The children rejoiced, and I felt ill.
"And your master?"
There was a banging noise. The man from my dream stepped out from the curtained private area. He bowed to us and hobbled over to the table, moving like an arthritic crab, all sideways stepping and gnarled limbs. Easing into a seat before us, he spread a deck of cards on the table.
"Come in, dear lady and gents, and have a look upon your future. We are but humble folk, dear miss, and think..."
Here Hardgrove stopped and looked at us, his eyebrow raised. He recognized me.
"Miss, how pleasant to make your acquaintance."
For one terrifying moment, I thought he'd mention the dream.
"And your companions? How charming."
He nodded to the boys. Blackwood nodded back. The magician changed upon the instant. He stretched and popped his joints into place, so that his legs straightened and his head settled right on his shoulders.
"A 1,000 pardons, dear gentlefolk.
I mistook you for easy marks that might be swayed by pity to donate a few coppers.
How may I assist you?"
"We wanted to join his lordship on a charity visit," I said, glancing at Blackwood. "I know it's not his usual day of the week." Hargrove took a glass bottle of something from his collection on the table, poured a little liquid into a tin cup, and handed it down to Charlie. The smell was frightful.
"Drink your gin, that's a good girl."
She took it with glee. "You know, I'm not sure that's appropriate for a growing child," I said, watching her guzzle it.
"Well, I tried to keep her in ale, but it's an expensive habit."
He laid out 3 cards. They showed a woman with a wand, a man with a sword, and a grinning skeleton that capered down a road. This was unlike any game I had ever played.
"I'm the magician, Jenkins Hargrove, purveyor of the finest arcane artifacts and occult odds and ends. I read tarot, tell your fortune, traffic with spirits, and raise the dead. But only on a full or new moon, and never on church holidays."
He looked up, his dark eyes dancing.
"You're sorcerers. Come down from your lofty perch to gawk at the little people. How refreshing."
He turned the cards face down, and when he flipped them up again, their pictures were different. They showed a boy and girl kissing, 7 coins falling through the air, and a man with a cloak and a pointed hat making a toy soldier dance. Hargrove narrowed his eyes at me.
"I've never seen a female sorcerer before," he said.
"I'm not commended yet."
"Hmm. Magic is a dangerous business, girl, especially for one so young and lovely as yourself."
He snapped his fingers, and a gold coin dropped out of thin air and into his hand. He bit it in 2, spit 1 half onto the table, and waved his hand over the piece. It transformed into a bright, golden beetle that opened its shell and beat its thin wings. I leaned in, stunned by the display.
"Real magic,"
Hargrove said, waving his hand again and returning the beetle to 1/2 a gold piece, "is about pushing the limits of what can and cannot be imagined.
But I expect you're all still content with starting fires and making it rain."
He swept the cards back into the pack and slid it into his purple-orange-red coat. "At least our magic is perfectly natural," I muttered, stung by his rudeness.
"I won't have the order insulted," Blackwood said.
Magnus put on his glove and poked at the gold piece, mystified.
"Of course not,"
Hargrove said, steepling his fingers. His nails were uncommonly long.
"We mustn't insult our faithful friend, Lord Blackwood, must we, children?"
Charlie hugged the magician, making it clear where her loyalties lay. He grinned, his mouth full of surprisingly white teeth, and stroked her hair.
"My Lord Blackwood, can you accept my apology?"
"Of course I forgive you," Blackwood said, in a tone that indicated he wanted to get out of here and would say anything to make that happen.
"The Blackwood family is generous with its charity." "Did you know that?" Hargrove said to me and Magnus. "Yes, I've been on the receiving end of their charity many times in my life."
He didn't sound as nice as the words implied.
"We are always happy to help in any way we can," Blackwood said, staring at the door like it was the closed gate of paradise.
I never imagined he could look so unsettled. Honestly, I found it a little enjoyable.
"And you are so helpful, my lord, especially seeing as I can only make so much money by way of charms and totems. Your order, my young friends, is not generous with what it will allow magicians to do."
"Why would the order have any say in your affairs?" I said. Granted, I could understand why sorcerers would want to keep magicians under control.
"We must blame the accursed Howard Michaelmas, my dear girl. He's the one who thought it such fun to rip a hole in time and space, to summon those evil ancients from some far distant world. He's to blame, along with that witch, that Mary Willoughby. They ruined it for the rest of us." He sighed. "Did you know the magicians flourished back in the Golden Age, when good Queen Elizabeth was alive? We were the most learned, the most ambitious. We were the future."
He took the half piece of gold off the table, gripped it tightly in his fist, and presented the piece whole and intact. When I touched it, it turned into a brown cockroach and leaped at me.
I cried out, and Hargrove stamped on the bug, squashing it into the floorboards. "That, my dear girl, is exactly what happens to my kind. We were stamped by the order's boot. But never fear, for a roach is impressively difficult to eradicate."
He removed his foot, and the unhurt insect dipped its antennae and scampered away. The children tried to catch it.
"The order only flattened us, didn't kill us. Sorcerers are nothing if not compassionate."
The feeling in the room had turned bad. Even Magnus looked uncomfortable.
"Perhaps we should go," I said.
"Without your fortune told, my dear?"
Hargrove took out his cards again and shuffled them.
"Care to learn your future? Care to know the identity of your admirers?"
He looked at Blackwood and Magnus.
"Or do you have the names already?"
He leaned back in his chair and rested his boots on the table. Any desire I had to speak with this man, to learn how he'd crept into my dreams, had vanished. I couldn't stand to be here another second. Blackwood placed a few coins on the table, and we walked quickly for the door.
"Return any time, young miss. I'm sure we'd have much to talk about." Hargrove called as we hurried down the steps and back to the carriage. The ward was a most welcome sight. Blackwood removed his hat and rubbed his eyes. Magnus stared at the floor, the muscles in his jaw working.
"What exactly were the terms of the royal pardon for magicians?" I asked.
"In exchange for their lives, they would take no apprentices and perform no public magic," Blackwood replied. "When this generation of magicians dies, their magic will end in England forever. To break the pardon is to forfeit your life."
"That's cruel," I said. "Michaelmas was only one man. Why punish the rest so harshly?"
"Because you cannot trust a magician's work."
"Why not?"
"Because they are evil."
Blackwood turned from me. The conversation ended. "Thank you for escorting me," I whispered, my voice dull. We were silent all the way home.
Chapter 8. My lessons the next day were another disaster. I set fires when I was meant to form ice, and drowned flames under torrents of water.
I tried the breathing exercises to clear my mind, but they only made me more anxious. Magnus encouraged my skills, while Blackwood silently judged the lack of them. Afterward, while we were filing out of the room, he approached me. I tried to excuse myself before he could tell me what a failure I was. But he surprised me by saying,
"It would be my privilege to escort you to Madame Voltiana's. She is my sister's favorite dressmaker, and would be happy to service you with compliments of my family."
He stood with his hands behind his back and spoke as though conducting a business transaction. It took a moment for me to understand that he wanted to pay for my new clothes.
"Thank you, but I couldn't possibly. It's too generous. And I really didn't want to be in any special debt to Blackwood."
Nonsense. You must be suitably dressed for the Queen's commendation in June."
"I couldn't repay you. Besides, I have clothes."
"Miss Howell," he whispered, "you haven't considered Master Agrippa. I know he meant his daughter's wardrobe for you, but I've seen his face these last few days. Perhaps a change would do him good."
How stupid could I be? I would do anything to save Agrippa pain. "In that case, my lord, I accept your offer. You're very kind."
"It's merely a responsibility. Someone must think of these things," he said with a wave of his hand, as though he were going over the monthly accounts.
Only Blackwood could make someone feel like an oaf for thanking him. Madame Voltiana's was a fashionable establishment on a bustling street in Mayfair, with gold lettering over the door. I'd never been in a dress shop before, and I gazed around in wonder. Swatches of expensive silk and satin lay in folds. Gowns of frothy lace sat on dressmaker dummies. Women in white caps sewed, barely looking up from their work. A young lady, too richly dressed to be employed in a shop, sat on a sofa with a cup of tea. When she saw us, she rushed over.
"George, you're late. Mama wasn't about to let me go without a chaperone, but I convinced her."
The girl kissed Blackwood's cheek. I assumed this had to be his sister. Otherwise, she was very forward.
"You had better do as you're told in the future," he said. But there was no harshness in his tone. He actually smiled.
"How dull life would be if I only did that."
She was bold. I found I rather liked her. Blackwood turned her to me.
"May I present my sister, Lady Elizabeth Blackwood?"
"You must never call me Elizabeth, as it sounds practically ancient. Eliza will do," she said, beaming.
Eliza had the same colouring as her brother, the pale skin and black hair and green eyes. But that was the extent of the similarity.
Her whole person vibrated with energy. She wore a deep purple day gown, one that beautifully set off her hair and eyes, but was too extravagant for a simple outing. She kissed my cheek before I could say hello.
"We're going to be friends," she announced. "George Roden said you seemed clever, which is a sight more than other girls in my circle. I dare say they've taken to staying quiet so as to better catch a husband. I don't need to be modest, of course. Who wouldn't want a Blackwood? Arrogant, perhaps, but true."
At that moment, Madame Voltiana swept through a pair of gold curtains. She was a fairy, half a head taller than Blackwood and thin as a reed, with purple skin and a snarl of moss-green hair.
"My lord, you do me too much honour."
She took his hands to his embarrassment.
"And Lady Eliza, always your servant."
She curtsied to the girl.
"My lady, are you in need of anything in particular?"
Madame Voltiana smiled, revealing a mouth filled with sharp black teeth.
Eliza pushed me forward.
"This is my dear friend, Henrietta Howell, and she must be properly equipped."
Voltiana stood back, clapping her hands as she studied me. She wore a great gold monstrosity of a gown, with enough frills and flounces to drown a normal woman. I was growing more and more nervous at the thought of being dressed by this fairy.
"I see."
With that, Madame Voltiana burst into violent tears, turned and fled through the curtains. Blackwood and Eliza looked at each other, clearly surprised.
"I'm sure she'll be back," Eliza said, attempting a smile.
Sure enough, after a stunned moment, Voltiana returned, composed.
"Forgive me," she said, flicking away a tear from her thin cheek. "The challenge was almost too great, but I shall triumph."
She pointed at me and nodded.
"Yes, girl, you will be my masterpiece."
Perhaps I should run. It took her 15 seconds to pop me up on a stool in front of 3 mirrors, while she grunted and sighed and measured and pinched me, turning me this way and that. Eliza chattered, discussing different cuts and colours. Almost as soon as I was up on the stool, I was dragged down again and seated on a sofa. Eliza sat beside me, explaining certain fashions with the air of an expert. Lovely shopgirls in different coloured frocks and gowns paraded choices before me, in and out of the curtains so fast I hardly had time to see what the fairy had in mind. I looked around for Blackwood and found him talking with one of the seamstresses, a pretty blonde girl. He smiled at her, obviously enjoying their conversation. She laughed at something he said. Interesting. Perhaps my wardrobe wasn't the only reason for this visit.
"You'll need red," Eliza said, snapping her fingers at a shop girl. "Your complexion is positively designed for red, as you're so dark. No pinks. Pink will be the death of you, and green will turn you sallow. Yellow might work, but only the right shade. Ivory! It's the only thing. What do you think?"
I had no idea what to say, so Eliza started another conversation.
"Julian Magnus is one of your fellow incumbents, isn't he? To be frank, I rather hoped he'd come with you today."
She turned toward the doorway as if to check whether he'd appeared.
"Mama would be horrified at my saying so, but he's so good-looking, it could drive anyone to distraction. And he makes me laugh. Of course, he hasn't a penny. Therefore, he's totally unsuitable."
"Oh?" It was all I could think to say. I liked Eliza's spirit, but I didn't like her being so mercenary about Magnus. If a man talked about a woman that way, I'd have called him a cad.
"He's not the Magnus seal-bearer. His cousin is, and his cousin is fat and married." "Shame," she sighed. "One never thinks of handsome boys as being without wealth. Beautiful women who live in poverty are an everyday tale.
Eliza clapped her hands and the shop girls departed.
You'll have 3 day dresses and 3 for the evening, along with gloves and accessories and such. Not your commendation gown, though. I'm going to dream up something special.
It occurred to me that Eliza was used to having her way over every living creature.
Perhaps we might discuss it together, I said. Nonsense! My taste is bound to be better than yours, she said, waving her hand as if to dismiss me.
The remark stung. There's no need to be rude. Eliza gasped, putting a gloved hand to her cheek.
You're cross with me.
No, I'm not, I said, but to my surprise she shrieked with glee.
No one's ever cross with me. No one ever calls me rude. Listen, that settles it. I know it's almost 2 months off, but you simply must be our special guest for the court player's annual dream.
I had no idea what any of that meant. Pardon?
A Midsummer Night's Dream. You know, the play. It's a social obligation every year, and it would be tedious, except that the court players are the only troupe with actual fairies as actors. So it's marvellous. You'll be in our box. Say yes, right now.
I'd never been to the theatre before. The closest I'd come was the Christmas play we performed each year at Brimthorn, so this was massively exciting.
Thank you. Yes, I said, feeling overwhelmed. Not at all. This is wonderful. I'm ever so glad they found a lady sorcerer I could be of an age with. When the last one was alive, I was too young.
That was a baffling thing to say. The last one was 400 years ago. We were all a bit too young to be her friend. Eliza looked at me as if I were an adorable fool.
No, dear. 4 years ago. Remember? Gwendolyn Agrippa?
What are you talking about? I felt as if I'd missed an important conversation. Eliza gasped again.
They never told you. Oh, they're positive fiends, all of them. Keeping you ignorant of something like that. Well, what are you talking about?
I couldn't help speaking harshly. Eliza rolled her eyes.
Gwendolyn Agrippa was a sorcerer. Or at least she was going to be. She tested positive for powers at her baptism when she was a baby. Don't look shocked. They baptize girls as well as boys, for tradition's sake. And you can imagine everyone's reaction when she was found to have an active ability. The first girl in 400 years. She received a stave, was an incumbent in her father's house. Good Lord, did they think you'd never find out? They thought she was the prophesied one, you know. Then she died of that piddling little fever, and they had to find another. So, I'm ever so glad you're here, she beamed.
I thought I would be sick. Palehook had said I'd much to live up to.
I always thought Miss Agrippa to be among the brightest lights in our society.
Some had clearly believed Gwen to be the prophesied one, which meant that some would search for reasons to despise me. After my recent efforts in the obsidian room.
You look ill, Eliza said. What's wrong?
This is a great deal to take in, I murmured.
Don't tell George I told you. Dear boy, he's positively the most wonderful brother, but he does tend to think his word is law. Back in a tick, she said, and bounced off to drag Blackwood out of his conversation with a seamstress.
Watching them, I wondered what Blackwood thought of Gwendolyn Agrippa's status as the prophesied one. We were soon back out on the street. Eliza drove off in her family carriage, leaning out the window to wave to me.
Come next week for tea, she called.
She likes you. Eliza doesn't like most girls, Blackwood said, sounding rather impressed.
He absently twined a pink silk ribbon around his hand. I was certain the pretty seamstress had given it to him. I smiled wanly at his comment.
My mind was preoccupied.
A surprise, miss,
Lily said when I entered my room that evening. 7 parcels lay on the bed.
Your clothes, from Madame Voltiana. That was just hours ago.
Incredulous, I opened a bundle and uncovered a gorgeous wine-red evening gown with gold embroidery.
How is it possible? Madame Voltiana's special. Works like magic. I suppose it is magic, isn't it?
Lily giggled as she laid out my clothes.
These will suit you ever so much better. How about the red for tonight, miss? We'll do your hair lovely again.
Besides the gowns, there were stockings, a chemise, even knickers trimmed with lace. Everything was pure white. In my old life, such delicate things would have been impossible to keep spotless. There were soft goatskin gloves in fawn and cream. I petted one against my cheek and sighed. Every Christmas Eve, I'd listened to Jane Lawrence whisper about how she longed for kid gloves. Perhaps I could send her a pair this year. There were flannel and cotton petticoats, and also a black velvet hip sheath, perfect for carrying a stave. Madame Voltiana had thought of everything. I sat on the bed, unable to truly enjoy the presents. What Eliza had said about Gwendolyn Agrippa kept gnawing at me. And besides that, the images of yesterday's slums kept repeating themselves as I admired the gowns. Who was I to wear such fine things when so many were suffering? Lily, where do you come from?
Miss?
Where's your family now? The girl's smile disappeared.
My family's all gone, miss. Kallax, the child-eater, carried off my folks and sisters. Gram felt the only safe place for me'd be behind the ward, so she got me a position in this house. I'm grateful, mind. It's safe here.
She played with the sleeve of a yellow tea dress.
I'm sorry,
I murmured.
The past's the past, miss, Lily said, bustling to organize my fantasy table. Shall I help you dress for dinner?
We chose the wine-red gown, and the color did flatter me, bringing out the darker tones of my skin. Lily pinned up my hair so elegantly that it appeared almost beautiful. While Lily arranged the ringlets by the sides of my face, she clucked her tongue.
You're lovely, miss. Just as he said.
Who?
Rook. He's ever so nice.
Lily flushed a deep pink.
The others don't like to be around him. But he's beautiful. Even with the scars.
Her open admiration for Rook surprised me. But why should it? Rook was my dearest friend, and I should be happy she could look past his scars to see the person underneath. I really should.
Do you like him, Lily?
My tone was surprisingly clipped. I felt a kind of low anger. I forced myself to stop. What right did I have to be angry at Lily? None.
Suppose I do, she said, lowering her eyes shyly.
For some reason, my stomach began to hurt.
Yes,
I said.
Do you know where Rook is, by any chance?
I found him sweeping the stables, humming as he worked. The horses blustered, the happy sound they made when all was well. Rook went to Magnus's mare and rubbed her nose.
Hello, tricky beauty, he said, laughing as she nuzzled at his shoulder.
Nothing for you tonight. Can't have you growing fat, can we?
Hello, I said, feeling strangely shy.
Nettie?
Within the stalls, horses whinnied and stomped. Clearly I had disturbed them. Rook gazed at me, his mouth open.
You're a vision.
I'd never felt more bizarre, standing there, in an elegant evening dress, while Rook cleaned out the stalls.
I missed you today, I said.
I missed you too,
He moved to collect a bucket of water.
Are they treating you well?
Compared to Brimthorn, what isn't good treatment? Mostly I see to the horses, which I like. I've taken on a few extra tasks, just to see they get bedded down properly.
He reached out and stroked one of the carriage horses.
I give them hot water and oats at night, instead of hay. Master Agrippa's pleased with how much better they seem.
You are better, aren't you? He murmured, laughing as the horse whickered in response. Rook was a genius with animals.
Don't let them work you too hard.
Work keeps me sane. Always has.
Of course. It was a distraction from the pain.
The servants are kind.
They aren't rude, he said. Lily's quite nice.
He lit up.
Funny too. Knows a million jokes, and 20 card games.
The cold, angry feeling flared up again inside me for one instant. I quashed it.
She's the sweetest girl.
More silence. Rook's expression when he looked at me seemed pitched somewhere between admiration and sadness.
He picked up the bucket,
wincing a little. When we were children, he would carry water up the long hill from the well. To help with his stiff hand, I would grab one end and he the other. Sometimes we'd play games to see who could slosh the least.
May I help?
I asked, desperately grabbing for the handle.
No, of course not, he pulled back. You can't ruin your new clothes.
I can carry a bucket.
The fluttering lace at my elbow tickled me. All right, perhaps this outfit was not entirely appropriate for manual labor. Rook agreed with my thoughts.
Not as you're dressed now.
These clothes are just a part I need to play for the sorcerers.
Every word seemed to widen the breach.
Nothing's changed.
Rook frowned.
Everything's changed.
The sorcerers were different from everyone else. Irretrievably different. They dined lavishly, while less than a mile away, people starved. They took trips outside the ward to walk for a few hours among the impoverished, only to come straight back again. My path led me away from people like Lily and Charlie and Rook. The kind of people I'd grown up with. The kind of person I'd been. My throat tightened.
How are your scars?
Do they hurt?
That's not something you should trouble yourself with now.
He dropped his eyes from mine.
Will you at least take care of them, and not go mad with the pain?
I said stiffly.
Of course,
he replied. The silence grew between us.
Well, I have to go back. They'll be starting soon.
He paused for a moment. Brooke with his bucket. Me with my damned fine dress. I turned and rushed away, my long skirt whispering over the ground.
Wait!
He sounded worried.
My scars do hurt.
Oh? I almost tripped over myself in my haste to turn around.
They hurt this way before the attack at Brimthorn. So tell Master Agrippa, and the rest of them.
He looked off toward the darkening evening sky, with the clouds rolling in.
Tell them something bad might be coming tonight.
Chapter 9.
Are you certain? Agrippa asked, his glass of claret half raised to his lips.
We were seated at dinner, where I toyed with my roast beef.
Rook isn't the type to invent things.
I hope the old Shadow and Fog does show himself tonight,
Magnus said, spearing a Yorkshire pudding and spooning gravy on top of it.
I'd a new coat made, especial for the occasion, and Korozov should see it, while it's still in fashion. Don't be too eager, Blackwood said. For all we know, it might be Relum.
That silenced everyone. Relum, the skinless man, was the most threatening of the ancients. Beasts like Molochoron and Korozov were just that,